From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on May 27th, 2011, on Twitter. Congressman Anthony Weiner had become a rising star in the Democratic Party, a progressive fighter who knew how to use social media to create viral moments. But that day in 2011, Weiner was not using Twitter to create a public sensation. At least he didn't think he was. He was attempting to use Twitter to send a picture of himself in his underwear, highlighting his genitals, to a woman he had never met in person. The congressman thought he was sending a private message, but he accidentally made it public, and you probably know what followed. At first, Anthony Weiner denied posting the image, but then held a news conference to confirm that he had exchanged explicit messages and photos with six women over 3 years. 2 weeks later, he resigned from Congress. But Weiner wasn't done with politics. After a two-year hiatus, Weiner announced that he was running for mayor of New York City in 2013, and that day he invited a filmmaker to come shoot a documentary about what he hoped would be his triumphant return. The filmmaker's crew was there for almost everything, behind the scenes, including difficult conversations between Weiner and his wife, Huma Abedin. And instead of a triumphant return, they documented a second sexting scandal and the crumbling of Weiner's career. This week, the Little Theater is showing the new documentary, titled simply, Weiner. NPR calls it one of the most intimate and detailed portrayals of political failure in modern American history. You're going to hear from the filmmakers in just a moment, but first let me introduce our panel in studio. Dr. Kathleen Donovan is here. She's an assistant professor in the Political Science Department, the Legal Studies Program, and Statistics Program at St. John Fisher College. Dr. Donovan, thanks for being here. Also here is Dr. Hinda Mandel, assistant professor in the School of Communications at RIT. Dr. Mandel, thank you for being here.
Very happy to be here.
And Joe Rittler is here, former chief of staff for the Democrats in the Monroe County Legislature. Joe, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
All right, before we have our discussion about this film, which our panelists have now had a chance to see, I want to bring in the filmmakers. I had a chance to talk to them by phone. This is Josh Kriegman and Elise Steinberg.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Well, let me start with kind of based on what you told NPR, which is that one of the things you hope viewers of this documentary take away is that theater is a big part of the political show. But you couldn't even have known a couple of years ago that Donald Trump was coming. I mean, that's all sort of icing on the cake for you in some ways, isn't it?
Yeah, in a certain way. I mean, it definitely, the Trump phenomenon that we're all watching and many of us, I think, are scratching our heads or, you know, some of us are worrying about it. This, what we're seeing now unfold in the presidential election, you know, does speak to, I think, one of the main themes of the film, which is just how much our politics and our political conversation is driven by spectacle, and it's something you certainly see out in the Anthony Weiner story.
Yeah, and Josh, I want to just ask you, particularly having known Anthony Weiner, he was theatrical, but before all of the scandal, he was a rising star in progressive politics because he was willing to be a little theatrical, kind of flamboyant, but he was willing to make strong, passionate arguments when a lot of progressive voters were hoping for someone like that. And to some degree, that helped fuel his rise, didn't it?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, one of the interesting things about Anthony's story is exactly what you say. Part of the way that he became a real player in terms of the progressive left is that he understood how to speak in a way that really resonated for many people who were yearning for a voice that was passionate and in some ways a little bit argumentative and unafraid to, you know, speak his mind. And as you see in the beginning of the film, he, you know, get up on the floor of Congress and literally scream for progressive values. And that was something that he understood how to play to the rhythms of the press in that way, and it was working really well for him.
And so once the scandal happens, he, of course, resigns in 2011. He announces his comeback in 2013. And Josh and Elise, my understanding is you had floated some kind of an idea for a film, and he kind of called you right away and said, bring the camera, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. You know, Josh had worked for Anthony before getting into filmmaking, and we teamed up together, and we were looking for a dynamic character to follow. And when, when this opportunity came along to film with Anthony, we knew it was something we just couldn't pass down. And when we started out, we had no idea what would happen. We knew it would be exciting. And then, of course, 6 weeks in, Anthony's at the top of the polls. And everyone's scratching their heads and thinking, you know, this could be one of the more remarkable comebacks in recent American political history. And then, of course, things took a different turn.
Sure. the reawakening of the sexting scandal or round two. And from there, what surprised me most in the film is that They didn't shut you out after that. He ends up cratering. He gets 5% of the vote. I mean, he comes in way down in the polls. But they let you be there all the way through for just about everything. And so what I wanted to ask, I was very curious about, is there's a lot, obviously, that we don't see. I mean, obviously, there's most of what you film we don't see because you've got to cut. But there are moments in the film where Huma or someone will say to you, you know, not right now, guys. You know, give us a little time and space. I imagine that had to happen a little more often than we saw. I mean, Huma in particular, I felt awful for. Were there moments where they told you, you can't be here? Or did most of the time, did they say, if you're going to be here, be here?
No, there were definitely moments when they asked Josh to turn off the camera. Josh did the shooting primarily. And one ground rule going in was that at any time, if anyone felt uncomfortable or wanted Josh to turn off the camera, he did. And you see some of those moments in the film. But, you know, I think this question about why did they allow us to film even after the scandal broke, I think, you know, this is something that we wondered about ourselves. And it's a question that we pose in the film when, you know, we ask Anthony directly, why did you allow us to film this? And at the end, Anthony does give us an answer when he says that he wanted to be viewed as the full person that he was instead of a punchline. And I think, you know, that was certainly our intention with this film, to take somebody who had just been so ridiculed and judged and offer a more human and complicated look. So I think that was their intention, to offer a version of their story that was different than the one that was playing out in the tabloids.
I think Huma's story is a fascinating one, and she is such a strong and smart woman who is building her own career, independent of Anthony Weiner. And I think, in terms of her career, she's apparently going to be just fine. She's doing very, very well for herself. One of the things that may be uncomfortable in light of the documentary are some of the people who have come out and sort of reignited those judging Huma stuff. Why would you stay with him? I never think that's fair. I never try to get inside someone's marriage or assume anything for them. But I also, as a human being, watched your documentary and I thought, boy, it's hard not to feel bad for her, watching him self-destruct and make the bad choices. Did you have to separate yourself from that? You know, did you get to know her? Did you feel bad for her?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, you're exactly right. What we wanted to do is to show this, like, natural impulse that we have to judge, and especially women, at the center of some of these media scandals. I mean, she was criticized for staying in the marriage. She was criticized for being at the press conference. And, you know, there are many, many women whose husbands did something wrong or embarrassing, and they were criticized for it. And why should these women be judged for mistakes made by their flawed husbands? Shouldn't they be allowed to make their own decisions? And our hope with this film is to question those judgments and go beyond them. And that was our hope with this film. And I think that, yes, there are people that will continue to do that, but then there are others that walk away from the film and sort of see that message that we were conveying.
Most of the reviews I've seen are very positive. IndieWire's reviewer called it the best political documentary ever made. NPR said one of the most fascinating and intimate looks at a political failure ever made. You know, if there's criticism at all, it tends to be that, you know, it was a little too sympathetic to Anthony. I didn't necessarily feel that way. But Josh, knowing your own work history with him, did you feel like you had to kind of make sure that you weren't presenting a portrait that was in any way overly sympathetic to him? Or did you feel in some ways that the media victimized him?
Oh, you know, I mean, I think one of the great things about going into telling the story from the vantage point that I had was that I had known Anthony as a full person. I had worked for him for a number of years. I was working in politics, and I had gotten to see what a multifaceted and complex person he is, in contrast to the caricature that he became through the course of his scandal. So, you know, our goal from a filmmaking perspective really was just to do our best to try to capture, you know, the full story, you know, and to show, you know, all sides of him, you know, including his flaws, but also his strengths. You know, one of the things that we appreciate about the takeaway from the film is that people seem to come away, you know, with feeling all sides. You know, we like to, one of the things that we've seen is couples watch this film and then they leave and go out to dinner and they fight the whole time. And that's, you know, in some ways, it's gratifying because that's our hope as filmmakers, is to present a complex portrait.
Well, let me wrap with this. I opened with a question on the timing, given Donald Trump's rise and the spectacle of the Trump campaign. There is part of me that thinks if Donald Trump did exactly what Anthony Weiner did, he would not leave the race and his support would barely flag at all. He's one of those sort of outlier candidates who is kind of immune to any impact of weird or scandalous news. But most candidates just like Anthony Weiner, Democrat or Republican or otherwise, would be taken down by this. They would go the Gary Hart route, and they would probably have their careers end. As filmmakers, do you find that unhealthy, and are you presenting a film that says we are overly judgmental of personal failure, or do you think those personal failures should be taken into account?
I think that we don't really actually, you know, our purpose with the film is not necessarily to answer that question, but it is obviously a question that's raised, and it's an important one. There doesn't seem to be any more, you know, a private sphere in public life. Everything, you know, seems to be considered sort of on limits and relevant to public service. And I think that that has, you know, interesting implications for the way that our politics unfold. And you have someone like Donald Trump who really, like you say, he seems to be just breaking all the rules and being rewarded for it in a way that is fairly unprecedented. But, you know, at the same time, we sort of see the moment that we're in now with Trump's campaign. You know, maybe there is a breaking point that he ultimately reaches or has reached, who knows. But I think that definitely sort of at the end of the day, one of the things that we are seeing is that no one really understands. It's hard to predict what's happening in today's politics.
Josh and Elise, congratulations on the success of this documentary. It's showing this week at the Little Theater in Rochester. And thanks for taking the time to come on the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
That's Josh Kriegman and Elise Steinberg, the filmmakers behind Weiner, which shows tonight, tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday at the Little Theater. There are 6:30 and 9 p.m. showings if you want to check out the documentary that a lot of people are talking about. And let me now turn to our studio panel. Once again, Kathleen Donovan is here from St. John Fisher College. And Kathleen, some of your work focuses on, your research is focused on public opinion and political behavior, those intersections, right?
Correct.
So for you, what stands out from the Weiner story and in particular this documentary?
I think one of the things that really stood out for me, because the film starts off by showing him making some of those impassioned speeches, right? And everybody has forgotten about that. When you bring up the name Anthony Weiner, there's really only one association there. And people like to, you know, for the most part, they don't think a lot about politics, right? And so the better we can put him in a box, the easier it is to sort of navigate the political landscape. And so he's been put in that box, and all of his accomplishments that have come before that have been washed away by that. So I thought that was very revealing.
Is that fair or unfair?
Well, it's unfair to the politicians, certainly, but, you know, to the American people, it's mostly fair. They got a lot going on. There's a lot of politicians around. Like I said, it's hard to navigate the political landscape. And so if you can stereotype people, you know, it makes life easier.
Well, let me turn to Hinda Mandel, who is from RIT and also well-suited to talk about this. In fact, you've done plenty of research on the coverage of scandal, and now you're teaching journalism at RIT. We're going to get into this hour the way the media has covered this, but let me just ask you broadly, did the film present it, you think, pretty fairly? What did you think of the documentary?
I thought that the documentary was a terrific watch, if you can say like a book is a terrific read. This documentary was a lot of fun. I found myself, quite surprisingly, really drawn to Anthony Weiner. A statement that could maybe get me in trouble. I wouldn't want to be married to him. I wouldn't even necessarily want to be friends with him. But his passion, in a way, won me over. He is a dogged spirit. He is unabashed in his views and even in what he did. And so he's totally compelling.
I thought you were going to say unabashed in his narcissism.
maybe that absolutely. Too. No, I have many thoughts on that as well. He's just... He appears to be kind of like this, you know, blank sheet of paper. He just is what he is. That's how he presents himself.
Yeah. Well, Joe Rittler, who was the chief of staff for the Democrats in the Monroe County Legislature and is now writing eyeonrock.com. That's a blog you can check out for Joe's view of the local political landscape, eyeonrock.com. Joe, as someone who's worked for Democrats, this is a man in the Democratic Party. Scandal knows no party. What stands out to you from the film?
Well, I thought it showed that, you know, he was very human. I thought that that came through throughout the whole thing, you know, with the involvement of his kids and his wife, and seeing kind of the background as far as what happened behind the scenes after the pictures came out. It was a really great film, and I think that was, for me, that was probably the most important or the most interesting part of it. You know, it's interesting, too, over this past weekend, New York City had their Pride Parade, and he was there marching in it with his kids. And so, you know, he's still doing the same thing that he was doing. And so, you know, I think that that was probably the most interesting part to me.
And Joe, I know a lot of your work focuses on local politics, but certainly as someone who's worked in the Democratic Party, you were very, very well aware of his rise. Had this not happened, where do you think he'd be right now?
Oh, who knows? Well, that's really hard to say because it's all dependent on other things. I mean, if we didn't have Chuck Schumer in office, maybe he could have been a senator or governor or who knows what. You know, those things happened and he's no longer there.
And Joe, you've seen politics on a lot of levels. Do we overstate this idea that a lot of politicians are self-destructive? Or do you tend to see that there is some kind of a trait in political leaders? Not all of them. I don't want to tar everyone. Certainly not all of them. But do you see that a lot?
Yeah, I think that that is a trait. But, you know, just as you mentioned, you know, the narcissistic tendencies of Anthony Weiner, I think, you know, that there are there's a lot of those types of tendencies amongst people who run for political office. They tend to be people who are risk takers. You know, they put themselves out on the line and put themselves out in front of the cameras and go out to all these meetings with thousands of people and talk to the community. So, you know, if they're risk takers in their business lives and their professional lives, odds are that they are probably taking other risks. You know, whether they're smart risks or not, that's an open question. And so I think that, you know, there probably is some higher prevalence amongst people who are politicians to be self-destructive. But the other thing, too, to remember is that, you know, the normal Joe on the street, if he sends a picture like Anthony Weiner did, it's not going to be all over the evening news and no one's going to know about it. So just because it's being reported on and it's in the public discussion doesn't necessarily mean that they are more likely to be self-destructive than the general population.
I think that's a good point. Listeners, if you want to join the conversation about political scandal, the Weiner documentary that you can see this week at the Little Theater and related issues, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Now, this film definitely takes a look at the way the media was covering Anthony Weiner and the way Anthony Weiner was responding to the media. I want to play a short clip, and this clip is related to a scene that you get to see in the documentary, even more behind the scenes. It's the interview that Anthony Weiner does with Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC. By this point, Anthony Weiner's numbers are starting to dip in the polls. That second scandal, that second wave has broken. Some people have called for him to get out of the New York City mayor's race. He has not gotten out of the race. And this is a chunk of that interview that actually goes on for about 5 minutes, and it's not very comfortable to watch, to be honest. But let's listen to this segment, and we'll come out and talk about it.
What I'm trying to get at, Anthony, is what drives you.
Okay, ask me that question.
Anthony, I mean it from a psychiatric level.
Dude,
I don't care about
I don't
your
really
phony
need your psychiatric
answers.
Questions.
I don't
what,
care
ask
about
me a
your
question.
Phony
Do an interview
answers.
Here. Do an interview.
You are being driven by some kind of demons in some
what
strange
kind of,
directions. And
Lawrence,
I'm
do you want
why...
to ask me a question, or do you have me on a harangue with a split screen? This can't be good TV for anybody.
This goes on and on. And I have to say, I watched that whole 5 minutes again this morning, that interview, and I found myself almost loathing both of them. Hinda is a journalism professor. On the journalistic side, that interview, was that grandstanding on Lawrence O'Donnell's part, or was he asking fair questions?
Well, I mean, I'm like laughing inside and outside
know,
right now.
I know.
The media has, you know, here Lawrence O'Donnell, he has the narrative that he's putting forward.
Yeah.
And he knows what makes for good TV. Anthony Weiner probably also knows what makes for good TV. And when I was watching this, the documentary, Weiner, my husband was watching part of it with me because I was watching it in my living room. And during this clip, my husband he was laughing and he was shaking his head and he goes, he's not right. He's not right. And what
he's talking about
Weiner.
Anthony.
Yeah. And what he meant is that for someone to be on the receiving end of such a pointed question and to be so combative about it and so dismissive about it, one would expect a politician who sent these tweets and these pictures to have at least a canned, deferential response, at least pay homage to the public. The public wants some sort of apology, at least give them that. But he refused, and he just, you know, steamrolled ahead.
And in the film, we see the aftermath. He goes home. The filmmakers are there. He's watching this interview online. and Huma Abedin, his wife, is there. Anthony is laughing. He thinks it's hilarious, and she thinks essentially it was awful. I found that one of the most uncomfortable moments in the film. What did you think, Huma?
Yeah, she was like...
I called you Huma.
Yeah,
oh, my gosh.
That's...
I'm going to start calling everybody in the building Huma. Hinda Mandel. Sorry, Hinda.
No, no problem at all. she's like, why is this funny? And she's such a... Yeah. I found her character, her personality to be really contained and quiet, mm-hmm. and strong. And when she said that, I said, yes, why is it funny? Why are you laughing like a hyena? But he was having a blast.
It looked like he didn't care that he was self-destructing to me.
Right.
Did you feel that?
Right. So I think that might be along the lines of a narcissist. And
yeah.
Obviously, I have no training in that whatsoever. But I've spoken to some psychologists and psychotherapists about narcissism in relation to sex scandal for my research. And they speak about these narcissistic wounds that people, including politicians are people, I guess, have during their childhood, where they've been wounded, neglected, abused, and they're seeking intimacy, but they don't feel comfortable getting a healthy type of intimacy. They don't know what healthy intimacy is. For them, intimacy is really harmful. It caused them wrong. And so they want attention, but they want it in the wrong ways. They want love, but they don't know how to make themselves vulnerable. So they act out in a hyper, stimulated way, oftentimes with, sexual compulsion.
Mm. Dr. Donovan, what did you make of that interaction between Anthony Weiner and Lawrence O'Donnell?
Interestingly, I sort of got a different take on it. He was laughing, sort of watching it afterwards, but in my mind, it was much more of a he recognized where he was at and that this was potentially unsalvageable. He does admit at one point, that he really screwed it up, essentially. And absolutely, he should have a canned response. And I think he gave the canned response over and over and over again. And he just finally reached a breaking point. Obviously, he lacks some impulse control. And I think we saw that, too, later when he tried to make a policy proposal, which, go figure, I don't remember what he was talking about. And he kept asking the media, any questions about this? Any questions that are on topic?
Yeah.
And it was just dead silent. And then finally he opens it up, and all they want to ask him about is the scandal. And so I think that was a very powerful moment to see how much power the media can have in driving the narrative, and that even when he wants to move past... he can't.
I think that's a canny observation on the media. And Kathleen, as someone who has researched this intersection of the way the public responds to political behavior, I look at that O'Donnell interview and I see someone who, this former congressman who used these kind of moments to build his fame and then didn't really know how to do it any other way to try to get out of it. This was his because that was his style when he was in Congress that made him popular.
Right.
He was combative. He would fight for progressive causes. He was not afraid to yell and to stick it back in someone's face. I don't think this moment called for that, but I see in this case someone who doesn't understand how any other way to play the game, and I'm looking at this going, Anthony, what are you doing? But I wouldn't have gone on that show in the first place because that's not real journalism.
Yeah, that's a great question. Why did he agree to the interview in the first place? I mean, he had to know that was going to be what was going to be talked about. But I think that's an interesting point. If that's the only way he knows how to deal with issues, and that's what has drawn a lot of his supporters is being impassioned and sticking up for himself and the things that he believes in, then, why not try that strategy? Maybe it'll work.
And you bring up that moment where he says to the media at that news conference, any questions about, he's holding this news conference on policy, he wants to help New York City. I'm running for mayor. I've got this 24-point plan. None of the media is having it. And Joe Rittler, as someone who was the chief of staff for the Democrats in Monroe County, you've been in those moments where you go, okay, we're getting a little wonky with policy, but this matters. Why isn't anybody caring about this? What do we have to do to get somebody to care about this? In Anthony Weiner's case, I think he could have run that race for mayor and gotten a little bit of traction and maybe held an early lead if he didn't have that second wave of scandal. I think the reason the media ignored all the policy after that was when you have a scandal and you go on the cover of People magazine with your family and you say you're getting better and you've moved on, and then the second scandal hits and you are Carlos Danger. I mean, almost a cartoon. I don't. At that point, I usually do blame the media for getting a little too fixated on these kind of things. It was hard for me to say the media was doing Anthony Weiner wrong when that second wave, that Carlos Danger wave, hit. As someone who's been a policy wonk who wants the media to pay attention, how did you feel about that?
Well, I thought that the media probably did, I think, spend a little bit too much time with it, especially as the campaign dragged on. But, you know, definitely it was something newsworthy and something that, you know, they had every right to ask about. But his reactions, like his reaction on Lawrence O'Donnell and even some of the other things he did, were just not appropriate for those settings. And he needed to really come up with a different strategy and do something differently if he actually really wanted to salvage the campaign, if that's what he really wanted to do, which maybe he didn't want to do. Maybe he just wanted to finish out the campaign and just say, well, you know, I tried. You know, maybe it got to a point where he wanted there to be a foreseeable end to the public scrutiny. And so he didn't, because I think, frankly, he had probably what could have been and maybe what was his most valued advisor and his wife, who, as you said, you know, seemed very grounded and very, you know, would it be able to come up with a more well-thought-out response and more well-thought-out guidance as far as how to respond to questions like those posed by Lawrence O'Donnell? And if he had just maybe listened to his wife a little bit more, maybe, you know, that could have tempered some of his other impulses to lash back.
I think he'd be in a much better position if he spent a lot more time listening to Huma Abedin and not himself. I think that's very wise. Let's get our only break of the hour. One of our listeners sent an email asking, are you going to talk about Carlos Danger? And I just mentioned Carlos Danger, but there is a section in the film, late in the film, with Pineapple and I forget her, Sydney Leathers, I think. I mean, just this documentary shows you these scenes. You can't believe you're watching this, but it happened. And the documentary is called Wiener. It is the story of Anthony Weiner's political downfall as he ran for mayor in 2013, and it's showing at the Little Theater all week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at 6:30 and 9 o'clock each night if you want to check it out. We'll come right back with our panel and get more of your questions and phone calls. If you have them, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. That's next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we'll discuss transportation issues as they relate to our veterans. Thousands of veterans are having trouble getting to basic doctor's appointments, let alone getting to work and feeling a stable life. We're going to talk about possible solutions and explore some personal stories. It's all next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and our guests in studio are talking about Anthony Weiner, political scandal, and media coverage, a lot of different related issues here. Dr. Kathleen Donovan, assistant professor in the Political Science Department, the Legal Studies Program and Statistics Program at St. John Fisher College. Joe Rittler is a former chief of staff for the Democrats in the Monroe County Legislature and the author of the new Eye on Rock, R-O-C, Eye on Rock. .com blog, and Dr. Hinda Mandel is an assistant professor in the School of Communications at RIT. And Judith emails the program to say, I often ask myself, why do people who are so smart do stupid things? Chalk it up to being human, I guess. And that's from Judy. And yes, being human, I think that's probably right. I mean, Joe Rittler made the point earlier this hour that, you know, if you could take a look at the entire human population, not just politicians, and I think they're human, that you might not even see a higher level of narcissistic self-destruction. Maybe you would, maybe you wouldn't. We don't know that. But to Judy's point about being human, a lot of people have wondered, is the media now in position to take apart budding political careers that in the past they wouldn't have? Gary Hart probably would have been president in 1989. He probably would have been the man inaugurated if he didn't have a political scandal that derailed his career. And Gary Hart to this day has contended that the media changed their behavior with that race and that the media goes too far in covering these personal scandals and the question of where the line goes. And our panelists don't have to answer this. You can answer this if you want, but I'm just curious, you know, where should the line be? And Dr. Mandel, as someone who teaches journalism, you know, we have to decide what we want to cover, how we want to cover it, and what a line should be. So maybe not where the line should be for a voter, but for what the media covers, whether it's Anthony Weiner or the broader question. How would you answer that?
Well, the problem is that so many of these sex scandals, they might be considered, oh, it's just titillation and sensational. It's not important. It's their private life. But the fact is that so many of these sex scandals involve illegal acts. And then the media should cover it, you know, including issues of sexual harassment, sexual aggression, rape, coercion. Now, with Anthony Weiner, there was nothing illegal about what he did, but he had the unfortunate coincidence of being a politician in the digital age. And when evidence is leaked to the media, there's no way that they cannot cover it. There's no way that we as media consumers cannot click. So if you're a politician and you have a sex scandal, my advice would be make sure nothing illegal is involved and make sure there's no evidence.
That's an interesting point, that distinction. And I wonder if you think, Kathleen, does the public make that distinction? Because when we could look at Elliot Spitzer, for example, and he was in trouble for a lot of reasons, but not the least of which could be because he was under investigation for having broken the law, not just having extramarital scandals. Do you think the public would make that distinction between, you know, an affair versus something that's a scandal plus illegality?
I think it depends on the situation. It'd be hard to say across all scandals like this. I think Hinda makes a great point that a lot of times they are co-occurring with other illegal activities, or in some cases, like Anthony Weiner or Bill Clinton, where subsequently, you know, they end up lying or perjuring themselves in some way. And so sort of the reaction to the scandal ends up becoming a scandal in and of itself. And I think you heard a lot of people saying, you know, it wasn't the affair. It was the fact that Clinton perjured himself under oath that really bothers me, kind of thing. And certainly during that era, his poll numbers stayed high, right? And people did seem to separate the personal from the professional. So I think it really depends on the situation. The public does seem capable of that. But yeah, at the end of the day, we love reading about that stuff, and the media is going to give it to us accordingly.
What do you think, Joe?
Well, I think that over time, you know, especially over the past several decades, the views on cynicism, people's, you know, views on the federal government especially have grown much more cynical, In fact, you know, Pew has found that back around 1958, 77% of people trust that the government would do the right thing always or most of the time. And in 2015, that was down to 19%. And research has shown that that as the cynicism goes up, the way that people view those scandals is slanted. That they, you know, if they're very cynical, they're going to view those scandals much more severely than if they're not very cynical. And so I think in part the rise in cynicism amongst the public plays a role in whether something that is not criminal but might just be poor personal conduct rises to the level of you know, warranting a resignation or something along those lines.
In other words, people are predisposed to not liking government already, and this just confirms for them that I never liked that guy. I never liked him or her. And Jill writes to the program, and Jill asks, she says, I think the Weiner thing brings up the issue of forgiveness. Can we offer politicians the same forgiveness as we would an acquaintance or someone we know? And Joe, you're saying that with the level of cynicism and the government approval rating so low, we're less likely to forgive.
Well, definitely less likely to forgive, but it's not possible. And in fact, Weiner tried. That's what he was trying to do. He was trying to get them to forgive him for his first issues.
See, this is where I've got such an issue with Anthony Weiner. I think he could have done okay. I think that the public does like a redemption story. You know, you brought up Bill Clinton. He's done okay for himself after everything related to Monica Lewinsky.
But can I
yeah, sure, absolutely.
But the thing with Bill Clinton is, and the thing that Anthony Weiner denied us, is he denied us a public grovel. And we are a confessionary culture. We love Oprah. We love her couch. We want people to say that they have sinned. You know, it's part of our long religious heritage as well. And Bill Clinton, it took him a while to get there. He had a series of denials. Some of them were quite ridiculous. You know, it depends.
The definition of is. Well, the definition of is, yes.
But he eventually made that public confession, and he cried. I think it was at a church in Martha's Vineyard where he did that. And Anthony Weiner has denied us that. And so it comes back to character, and is a politician's private character, the sex, the sleaze, the titillation, is that indicative of a problematic public character? And what I found in my research is that Some people say yes, some people say no. But I have a quote here from a survey I did. It was of like more than 500 people from across the U.S. It was a random sample. And this woman says here, if they're willing to lie and cheat on their spouses, destroy their family, it's terrifying to think about what they will do to us. So she makes that distinct connection between a politician's bedroom and private life and his, well, it's usually a his, we can get into that later, as opposed to a her, relationship to his constituents.
But Jill's follow-up is, but if his wife can forgive him, why can't we?
Well, but the thing is when we watch this show, we directly can look at Huma Abedin's face and we can see the pain that she's in. So it's unclear to us whether she's actually forgiven him, even though she says she has. Like she herself says in the film, my life is a nightmare.
I've got to agree with you. I actually said to my wife, we watched the film together, and I said, it looks like she hates him. You know, this documentary, there aren't a whole lot of moments that make you say, yeah, they've healed or they're working on it or, you know, that they're it's constructive. And she's a private person. I have to remind myself to, again, not judge. I don't want to try to get inside her head. It was just hard to watch. Those were the hard to watch moments where I thought, you know, I'm not going to judge Huma Abedin for staying or not staying or whatever she wants to do. But boy, this looks like it's got to be tough for her. So that's at least Hinda's answer to Jill's question. What do you think, Kathleen, in terms of forgiveness? Could Anthony Weiner come back to public life eventually?
Well, you know, speaking on the public earlier and that we like to stereotype, we also have a fairly short memory. You know, his name obviously, unfortunately, brings up the scandal inherently. I wouldn't put anything past him. Why not? You know, like you said earlier, we do like an underdog story, a redemption story. But I will say, yeah, we are a very, I like that you brought up the religious aspect. I was talking with some colleagues, one from France and one who's spent an extensive amount of time in France. And they noted that, you know, their politicians have sex scandals too, and they just don't care as much. And so we were discussing about why that might be. And, you know, maybe one part of it is the religiosity. Certainly, if you look at the survey data, the more religious you are, the more offended you are by those types of moral transgressions by politicians. But we do take it much more seriously than citizens in other countries. You know, like I said, if that's a religion thing or just a general American exceptionalism thing, I don't know. You know, we'll see. We'll see.
And on the subject of his name, Keith called the program to ask, does his last name play into the naming of the movie? And the answer, Keith, is undoubtedly yes. And it will definitely be tied to him. That is his name, and that's going to make it harder for people to forget. I agree with Kathleen there. But on the subject of the religiosity and the way people who are consider themselves more religious might be more or less likely to forgive in this case, you also see evangelical leaders posing with Donald Trump for pictures last week in front of a picture, framed picture of Donald Trump on Playboy. You know, so I'm not really sure if I can fully get my head around what I should expect of ostensibly evangelical or religious people in terms of their view of politics. You know, right now, if you view Donald Trump as a true born-again Christian, I'm not sure you're seeing politics clearly. I don't understand that. You know?
Yeah, certainly I tell my students all the time, I just add except for Donald Trump to everything I say.
Boy,
now in class. So
it's become the outlier, isn't it? It has become.
Never wear a hat unless you're Donald Trump. It's fine.
That's right. Joe Rittler, when it comes to forgiveness now, do you expect Anthony Weiner to try to have a career again in politics?
That's a really hard question to answer, but I would say probably, especially given his presence at the Pride Parade over this past weekend. He's still out in the public eye. You know, his wife is still active. She was there as well, marching with Hillary, which I thought was interesting as well, because in the movie there's this big debate about whether, you know, Hillary's going to force Huma to leave Anthony, which obviously is nonsense. And so I would not be at all surprised. I mean, look at Elliot Spitzer, too. You know, he resigned and he tried to come back, tried to run for comptroller, I believe, in New York City. Doesn't happen very often. especially if you resign in disgrace. But, you know, there's other folks. If you look at, like, David Vitter, senator from Louisiana, he admitted that he had frequented prostitutes, and yet he was reelected, and the people forgave him. And so
largely evangelical voters forgave him.
He ended up, though, invoking God in his press conference, saying God had forgiven him.
Yes, of course. It was very convenient. Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's good to know if God's forgiven you. You know, as voters would want to know that.
Yeah. I mean, how does it's love the sinner, hate the sin?
I believe that is the same. But I also want to ask Joe Rittler about something kind of related here, because we've been talking about the kind of person that becomes a big political personality, but may also be prone to self-destruction, as Anthony Weiner was, as not all politicians are, but as Anthony Weiner was. On the other side, you know, you may look at this and say, well, that's why I never want to get into politics, because the media goes nuts. You know, I think Anthony Weiner deservedly got in the media's crosshairs. But the media does fixate at times on personal foibles. We saw it at the county level with Steve Eckel, who was a Democrat in the county legislature. And Joe, just remind listeners what happened there with Steve.
Well, county legislators are part-time people. They have other jobs. And so Legislator Eckel also was a photographer, and he had an art portfolio online, which included some nude photos, including nude photos of himself. And the day before...
Artistic photos
in his portfolio of work.
In his portfolio of work.
You know, displayed on the internet. And it was like a day or two before Election Day, when he was up for election. The county Republican Party made a big stink about it and said basically that, you know, he's evil. And
I don't think they said evil.
That's the implication. Whatever. We can disagree. I agree to disagree. Okay. And
they clearly raised it as a character problem. Like, you know, what's going on with this?
Yeah, well, they said the issue was that he didn't have a disclaimer on there saying that, you know, if you're under 18, you shouldn't go on there. So therefore, you know, children were susceptible to viewing these images. So which, you know, whatever your view on that is, I think it just shows the power of the local media, especially in informing the public about these types of situations, because frankly, at that same time, there was a $300 million bid rigging scandal going on in Monroe County government that people and the comptroller were complaining about at that very same time. And yet what was covered at length in the days before the election? This thing with his art portfolio. And so,
and he lost.
And he lost his election.
And do you think he lost because of that?
Well, his district was it had many more Democrats than Republicans. And I can't say for certain, but I suspect that it did play a role in his losing election. And I think that, you know, that really had absolutely no reflection on how he was as a legislator. And, you know, how he advocated for people in his district and how he fought for, you know, greater transparency and oversight in county government.
Here's why I bring that up. I bring that up because the media certainly has covered LDCs. And Joe may think not enough or not early enough, but the media has covered it. But I have said before, and I stick with this, the public much more easily remembers and understands a sex scandal, a bid rigging scandal with quasi-government agencies and layers of government and contractors and funneling of money is a lot harder to understand. And I am not at all saying that it shouldn't be understood or considered. I'm saying that maybe it's a flaw in the media, maybe it's a flaw in our civic responsibility, but we tend to look at a sex scandal and say, I get that, and they understand it better.
I don't necessarily think it's a flaw in the media, you know, as far as the individuals in the media. I think it is a flaw in terms of the structure, the way that the media is structured, in particular the TV media, and especially local TV media. They just do not have the resources, really, to devote, to look into, you know, this 10-year history of how these guys were rigging bids and stealing money through phony invoices and all this other stuff. They just don't have the resources to do that. And it doesn't make for an easy 30-second story on the evening news, whereas some guy has an art portfolio with nude photos of himself out there and the Republicans are calling him a pervert, that's really easy to do a 30-second clip on. But that's a disservice to the public. Make no mistake about it. And I think that if the media were to somehow change their structure to allow for more resources, whether that be through combined investigative reporting or something different, that could be addressed. We still have some good investigative reporting from the newspapers around here, but even there, you know, there's lots of issues.
Let me ask the journalism professor. Do you agree that sex scandals are a lot easier to report on and understand for voters than the more complicated stuff that we see, LDC being just an example?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the narrative of political sex scandals, it's like the million-plus history that we all have with storytelling, or whenever language was developed. I don't know when that was developed. But sex scandal stories, they are very linear, simple stories. They're stories that even, I'd say, a 7 or 8-year-old can understand. You know, bad person, gets caught with his pants down, and how can you compete against that? How can the more serious public policy stories compete against that? Because we're drawn, I would argue, even biologically, it's our nature to find these stories of interest. So the media has to fight against human nature.
And don't we need to train the future journalists of the world to, I guess, be better diggers, understand how to access information, and hope that newsrooms will invest in that?
Yeah, I think part of it is teaching them literally how to tell news as a story, because we assimilate storytelling very easily in our brains. We don't assimilate public policy easily in our brains.
Okay. Question from Paul comes in by email, and I'll ask both the professors who've done some research on these kinds of issues because we're starting to run out of time. Paul writes, do we see this narcissistic behavior that causes politicians to engage in sex scandals occur more often in males than females? We do not hear of female politicians in the U.S. with scandals like this. That's from Paul. Hinda, I'll start with you.
I'm writing a book on that. So check out my website, omghinda.com, for when my book comes out, hopefully next year. I found 9 instances of women sex scandals. These are very recent occurrences. What's interesting is that when these sex scandals happen for women, in 7 of the 9 instances, they have political failure instantly. They don't become a political phoenix at all. Their political careers are done.
Are we talking domestically in the United States?
In the U.S., throughout the country.
What levels of government?
Local.
Okay.
Local. There has never been a major political sex scandal with a woman at, you know, in charge of that in this country.
Okay. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons why that is. One has to do a lot with opportunity, right?
There are far fewer women in
yes. government still today. You know, again, this is out of my expertise area, but from my limited understanding of attraction, men are typically attracted to women for beauty, but women are attracted to men for beauty and power. And so you have a man in power. There's a lot of opportunity. They're working long hours, odd hours. Traveling a lot, and women are attracted to them. And so I think if you add that opportunity there, plus the personalities, the types of people who get into politics, where whether it's because of narcissism or compartmentalization or whatever is going on in their head, but I think that creates a recipe for seeing a lot more incidences with men.
You just explained the answer to why when you see, usually, I think Paul's right, it's a man, an older male, was with a much younger female, and you go, how did that happen? But what you're saying is the attraction to power.
Yeah.
Okay.
Again, this is sort of evolutionarily speaking, right? The man can provide, et cetera.
Very interesting. Okay, down to our last minute. Should our listeners go see this documentary?
Oh, yes, and have fun. Yes.
Have fun?
Yes. Get popcorn and enjoy it. I'm glad that you're not Anthony Weiner or Huma Abedin.
Kathleen Donovan, should they see it?
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed it. But it was very revealing for a lot of reasons, so yeah.
Okay, but not revealing in the way they don't actually show you the photographs. I want to
subconscious fun.
Yes, you did. You said revealing, but thankfully the filmmakers left out a lot of the super salacious stuff there. So there is that. Joe Rittler, worth seeing?
Oh, absolutely. It was very engaging. Great film.
Okay, so 3 yeses. If you want to check out the film, it's called Wiener. The documentary shows Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of this week. So you've got 4 chances, 4 days to see it, and you actually have 2 different screenings: 6:30 and 9 o'clock. Each night, your chance to see it. And, you know, unfortunately, I suspect there will be more films like it in the future. We have this weird cycle in politics, and it doesn't matter the party. Our thanks to our guests, Joe Rittler, former chief of staff for the Democrats in Monroe County Legislature. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Evan.
Dr. Hinda Mandel, Assistant Professor in the School of Communications at RIT, and a book coming out, I thought, in the fall. When's the book?
Yeah, there's one in the fall called Scandal in a Digital Age, and then the next one in 2017 about gender and sex scandals.
Okay, well, you know, I suspect that the next scandal, we'll talk to you then.
Looking forward to it.
It's keeping you certainly in work and in demand. Thank you, Hinda. And our thanks to Dr. Kathleen Donovan from St. John Fisher College. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
All right, short break. More Connections next.